AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, Matt McNeil in Anton Troyer is kind enough to join us. Now, he's a professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University, author of numerous books, and an expert in Ojibwe. His new book, The Language Warriors Manifesto, How to Keep Our Languages Alive No Matter the Odds, is currently out, and he's kind enough to join us to talk about preserving the Ojibwe language. Anton, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Yes, thanks for having me on.
I also appreciate that because I know that during this time, I mean, you're a professor. I imagine you're having, like everyone else, you're doing everything from home at this point.
Yes, it's been a little nutty, but I'm sitting in a corner of my bedroom teaching most of my classes through Zoom while I have, you know, a fair percentage of my numerous brood of children running all over the house. So
I have friends who are other professors at other universities. The old double-edged sword, that's Zoom. How enjoyable.
Right.
your history is pretty remarkable. You have been pretty much the point person. I watched an interview with you about 10 years ago, and you were putting out the alarm and the warning at this point. If we do not start taking care and understanding and preserving the Ojibwe culture, it's going to disappear. And you of course, met numerous books. You've become a very passionate argument. You've made a very passionate argument. We should not be losing cultures, not in this country.
And, no, I think not anywhere.
Yeah, and I think the fact that you've gotten to the point, I'm just going to say from my perspective at least, and I know I'm not exactly the most, kind of in tune to it, but it does seem like there has been this revitalization and understanding that we do have to preserve the Native American cultures. So whether that's because of your instigation of the preservation, or whether it's just people kind of becoming aware that we shouldn't lose these cultures, it seems like the Ojibwe culture is at least not deteriorating as bad as it was. Is that a fair way to say it?
You know, a lot has changed just over the past 20 years and really accelerated over the past decade or so. I think, first of all, there's a tension for all human groups between cultural continuity and change. And we have to give ourselves permission to change over time. You know, if you look at people who are living in England 10,000 years ago, you know, painting their faces blue and worshiping maybe at Stonehenge, they're really quite different from folks there a few hundred years ago and folks there now, although at every point in time they were British. And so certain changes are okay, but certain things are lost too. Bodies of knowledge, ways of looking at the world. And I guess I've been deeply concerned about Ojibwe and many other indigenous languages. We're going from somewhere around 7,000 world languages now down only about 100 or so are actively and widely taught at colleges and universities. But what's been exciting for me to see with Ojibwe is that we have stuff that we did not have 20 years ago. A community, Lacouture in northwestern Wisconsin, you know, really hadn't been producing fluent speakers since about World War II. And now there's about 125 kids running around on the playground arguing with each other in Ojibwe at one of the most successful Ojibwe immersion schools in the country. And we've seen, you know, when I was starting, I was kind of an early entry into the academic work on Ojibwe too. And you could probably count the number of Ojibwe language publications on maybe one hand. And there are hundreds of them now. I couldn't even tell you exactly how many there are. It's still hundreds when you need many thousands. But we've seen growth in collegiate language programs, adult immersion programs, and K-12 immersion schools. So we're picking up some steam. I'd say the future vitality of Ojibwe is not certain, but it's certainly possible.
And you are also, did I see correctly that you're working on a Rosetta Stone version of the language?
Yeah, there is an effort in Mille Lacs to develop a variety of tools and resources for Ojibwe. And so we're doing a series of young reader books. And yes, there is a plan to develop Rosetta Stone. It'll probably take about a year and a half to develop the first year and a year for each subsequent you know, rollout for that, but they're planning a 6-year development of Rosetta Stone.
Your TED talk starts off with a very, you know, straightforward point that the Native American languages are the native languages. The English, right. The French, the Spanish, those were introduced languages. And one of the things that you really do from the Native American perspective, and I've been on the East Coast, and I've been to some of the Wampanoag and some of the other tribes that are on the Eastern Coast, there almost was, you do see the way that languages and cultures can almost disappear overnight, because it did seem like some of those earlier East Coast tribes, they just disappeared, and they really are gone forever at this point.
Oh, yeah. There are many thousands of languages in the world today that are very likely to become extinct. And there are a variety of reasons for that. You know, you need a certain critical mass of speakers. You need those things to be institutionally supported. Even groups like, you know, the Amish, who have tried to freeze their cultures and communities in time, really struggle. They lose people all the time. It's hard to maintain, you know, a cultural continuity, and for the Dutch or German speaking Amish with a language continuity, it's very difficult for a variety of reasons. A lot of the tribes on the East Coast of the United States, you know, have just been enduring colonization a lot longer than everybody else. They were the first to encounter, you know, early British or French or Spanish, you know, colonial efforts and disease patterns and genocide. So, and then that accompanied by the fact that the United States government tried to move a lot of the natives who were east of the Mississippi west, you mm-hmm. know, and a lot of those tribes ended up in places like Oklahoma or Kansas or whatever. So, you know, all of those things have put exceptional pressure. Plus, they're just very populous parts of the country. So native people kind of, you know, can get swallowed up by everyone else around them sometimes. Makes for special, challenging work.
Well, and it's almost, a currently alive archaeological dig. I mean, it's one thing to go to the Grand Canyon and dig down through the geological layers, but what you're having to do is piece together as much of a culture with what's still around as much as possible. And it's probably as difficult at times and frustrating at times when you realize this is only 200 years ago. I would have no problem being able to put piece this together, and I'm having a harder time today.
Well, of course, yeah. You know, probably one of the most famous examples in the world of, you know, a language that really went extinct coming back would be Hebrew, which hadn't been spoken for about 2,000 years. But, and it's an official language for Israel now and has millions of speakers. But if you listen to somebody today compared to somebody 2,000 years ago, you know, I'm not sure how well they'd understand each other. And so, you know, it is far easier and far more authentic to maintain you know, cultural and linguistic continuity than it is to try to recreate or reimagine something. But we're seeing this in other places too. You know, Welsh has 500,000 speakers now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're seeing this happen in all kinds of places where there are some successful language revitalization efforts. In the U.S., Hawaiian has just been incredible what they've been able to do.
And yeah, and that there is, like you said, there has been this attention that if we don't start preserving these languages, they're gone. And, you know, there is not just a cultural aspect. I mean, one of the things that they talk about at Fort Snelling is the use of Native American languages in the battlefield. You know, we were able to, it gave us an advantage revisiting, oh, well, if we get the Native American speakers here, we can actually, you know, they can't translate anything. And it was a tremendous success, a key part of American victory. If we, there are things that we can use these languages for that give a daily applicability. And sometimes, and nothing against something like French. I mean, French is a lovely language and stuff, but it really is truly something where this is our culture. This is, and whether or not we're Native American or not, this is North American culture. And if we don't embrace it, no one will.
Yeah, I think that's true. And certainly the Choctaw and especially the Navajo code talkers, you know, got a lot of press for, you know, contributions to the greater nation. But to me, you know, every language embodies a unique way of looking at the world and has unique tools for, you know, solving problems and things like that. And so to me, a lot of the problems that we are facing today, whether it's climate change or, you know, divisive politics or race relations or whatever. A lot of these things are, you know, developed as a direct result of colonization. And that colonial process has been dehumanizing to everybody. Like, Europeans were busy colonizing each other before they exported that way of dealing with problems to the rest of the world. And it's dehumanizing to them too. Why would we think that all the problems created by the colonial way of solving problems will be solved by the colonial way of solving problems? It just doesn't make sense.
It doesn't.
Embedded in indigenous languages are tools for all of the world to think differently, organize societies differently, approach problems differently, and solve the issues that are, you know, going to be plaguing everybody's future generations, seven generations from now, and nobody knows our names. Mm-hmm. And keeping them alive is not just about another pretty bird singing in the forest. It's about the health and vitality of all humankind.
Anton Troyer is joining us. The Language Warriors Manifesto is the book. Your mother, if I'm correct, was a member of the White Earth Ojibwe Nation. She's also was a lifelong resident of Leech Lake, Ojibwe. But you didn't learn the language. Well, I'm presuming you knew some of the language, but you didn't learn it as a fluent speaker till later in life, correct?
That's right. I was lucky to grow up primarily in a native space and had exposure to language in a lot of other dimensions of culture, but I didn't really value that until I left. And then when I did, you know, I guess I left wanting to leave home and never come back. And as soon as I left, I wanted to come home and never leave. But I ended up spending a lot of time with a spiritual leader, Ojibwe man named Archie Mose, who didn't speak English that well. And I guess I kind of had a more organic immersion experience with him. And sought out other great speakers and cultural carriers. And I was just fascinated by the minutiae of the language and also with the cultural experience that we use the language to share and teach about and do ceremonies in. And I never really thought any of that was going to take me anywhere. But if you flash forward a couple decades, you know, most of my elder teachers passed away, and I ended up being one of the younger speakers and cultural carriers who's getting a lot of pressure to step up and officiate at ceremonies and do things to help advance the language. And that's been a big part of my lifelong mission.
It's an interesting context because I when I was a kid and going to school, I tried to learn Spanish. I couldn't. And then I was in the military. I was in Germany. And German is a much more difficult language than Spanish is. But yet by the end of my tour over there, because I spoke it every day, I was actually quite fluent in German. And as you just described there, I mean, there is a level of this. As you talk about bringing the language back, it's having that day-to-day conversation ability that I think really pushes a language in much more and you know, creates a stronger foundation for the language and that culture by being able to, basically immerse yourself in that every day.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, think about what a kid goes through when they're born and they're not speaking any language. And then they listen to whatever language their parents speak for an entire year. And then after a year of listening, they say their first word, Think about how much airtime we have to get. So if a language program, for example, is like 20 minutes every other day, you know, for 30 weeks out of every 52, you know, like that's not going to get you fluent speakers, which is why the immersion model has been proven to be a lot more successful, where you do all of the instruction in the target language that you want the kids to learn. And they just, you know, they get a lot more airtime and regular use and practice, and they don't have to stop, think, translate. You just listen and react, and it's a little more total physical response. You know, you're responding and circumlocuting and using gestures and things like that, but people tend to pick it up a lot faster.
You bring up an interesting point because, you know, and obviously immersion schools, not only Ojibwe, but, you know, we have them pretty much all throughout the metro area of the Twin Cities as well. I've actually started to ask the question, why isn't a language option, Ojibwe, in the same sense as we have, you have to get Spanish, you have to get French, you get German, you have all these choices, you know, Latin right. even. And I mean, on one side, I think that it's just almost a common sense. Why wouldn't we have the native language as an option for all school students in the state of Minnesota? But I want to ask, I know sometimes there is a feeling of propriety a little bit that, you know, well, it's nice mm-hmm. and we're trying to preserve this for the Ojibwe Nation, but it's not necessarily I want two kids in suburban Wayzata necessarily using it as, you know, as a way to avoid their friends from hearing how they're talking. It doesn't do that, you know, not necessarily the language that could. I mean, what would you think about something like that? Is that something that eventually would that signify a complete acceptance, or would that be something that, you know, that's something a little more trashier than we want to do with the language?
You know, different native people and even different language advocates might answer this a little differently than me, but I'm of the view that, you know, the language should proliferate and be widely used and accessible to other people. And, you know, I have a lot of non-native students who take my classes, and certainly welcome them into that circle. And I think, you know, learning someone else's language is a great sign of respect and fascinating. And so, you know, I think that is to be applauded. I think the barriers that you do realistically have is, one is just capacity. Like most of the great, you know, Ojibwe teachers and speakers, they're already employed at some of these schools and programs that are popping up throughout the region. And so if you did want to make it available, you'd still need enough people deeply knowledgeable enough to like deliver the goods. So mm-hmm. I think you might have a little bit of a capacity issue if you, you know, moved it out everywhere. But certainly the goal is to keep building up speakers and schools and programs and, you know, kind of grow the base. And some of the things that we're, you know, thinking in strategically about that we really need to uncork that would be, you know, like Ojibwe teacher training programs at the college level so we can get people credentialed and fluent. And some of that stuff is, you know, in various stages of planning and development. We do have adult immersion programs which have been really successful. And, you know, I think those sorts of efforts can help us build up on the capacity issue. It may be the case, like, you know, Native people, I think have sometimes struggled feeling invisible and marginalized. We get imagined a lot and understood very little. And a lot of Native people sometimes even feel that we're invisible to ourselves, like, you know, we need a front seat and access to our language and culture. And I understand that feeling, but I don't think that should be, that the path towards that should be keeping anyone else away or pushing them down from the effort. So I certainly applaud everybody's, you know, engagement, support, and learning of Ojibwe.
Do you feel, one final question for you here, do you feel as if your work and the efforts that have been put forward by the other people trying to preserve this language, that they're at least for the next, say, 50 years or so, that, you know, that there is going to bear some fruit on the tree, per se, in the sense that you've got, you're starting to get there, you're starting to get more professors, you're starting to get more immersion schools, that this is going in the right direction as opposed to going in the wrong direction?
Yes, I do feel that we are making some really meaningful progress. I see it with, you know, numerous publications on the preservation end. I see it with, you know, the emergence of, you know, probably 20 different Ojibwe immersion schools in the U.S. and Canada. I see it with my own family, you know, like my grandmother, who's still alive at age 97, you know, was brought to a residential boarding school where she was prohibited from speaking Ojibwe. And it kind of broke down the intergenerational transmission of the language in my family. And I went about a relearning process and got my language, and I speak it with my kids, and kind of watching my daughter, Madeline, who graduated from college now and is actually a great speaker, who is part of this team that have been recording elders in Mille Lacs, and she'll be one of the, you know, authors on the three new books that we'll be publishing through the Historical Society, and just kind of seeing the reestablishment of an intergenerational transmission of language. And my family's not you know, alone in that. There are many other families who do it, and no language lives just with one person. So you kind of need a community around that. And I am seeing those things emerge, and it gives me incredible hope about not just the future of Ojibwe, but what humans can accomplish to overcome historical injustices and ugly chapters in our history.
Indeed. We definitely need to do that. The Language Warriors Manifesto, How to Keep Our Languages Alive No Matter the Odds. Anton Troyer, an absolute privilege. By all means, any new book you got coming on out, any issue you want, you've always got time on my show. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. We'll take a break. Come back. It's Matt McNeil right here on AM 950.